Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mark.
For your energy team.
Morning, the E12 Finance Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 19, 2013. Welcome, everyone. We have seven bills on the agenda today. First is Senate File 1003, Senator Bonoff, Parent-Child Home Program Appropriation. And we'll ask Senator Bonoff and her testifiers to join us.
Good morning. Start with how the program works.
Welcome.
Very deep. Unless you want me to.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about Senate File Number 2276. I apologize.
1003, I believe.
Thank you. Very good. Okay. The Parent-Child Home Program is a program I first became acquainted with, I would say it was maybe 4 years ago when Art Rolnick invited me to a woman's home to hear about this program. This woman, Beverly Grossman, single-handedly brought the Parent-Child Home Program to the Twin Cities. It's a program that started in New York. It's a program that has been franchised around the country for
48 years.
48 years. And during that time, all the data associated with the workability of this program has been gathered and can be viewed. So one of the things that is often heard as we talk about, you know, intervention with regard to our youngest children is how do we know it really is making a difference? Well, this program tells you it's making a difference. This program is a home visiting program that goes into homes 18 months to 4 years old on a voluntary basis. And I will let my testifier, Mari Forbush, tell you about the program. But another thing for you to know is, so the Jewish Family and Children's Service has been putting this on in the western suburban communities, as well as they've partnered with Way to Grow. And so they have done some outreach into Minneapolis. They've been doing this for many years. The woman who first became the benefactor gradually, you know, she couldn't do this every year for years, so they raised other money. I actually went with Jewish Family and Children's Service some years back to Cargill, and they've been a private funder. They've had many private funders. 2 years ago, we funded this program as a pilot. This bill expands that pilot so that we would have a partner in rural Minnesota, and we've identified that partner, as well as Way to Grow is interested in doing a pilot in the Twin Cities area. So Jewish Family and Children's Service, and by the way, they don't, when they serve the families they serve, these are not Jewish families. They're just like Lutheran services. They have a broad range of communities that they service. So this bill has three different pilots being funded in different areas. And the area in the rural area, we contacted Blandon, and they reached out to their community to find out where the greatest need was, and they identified the Northland Area Family Center. And I'm happy to speak more about that. But before I do that, I would call on my testifier to take you through the nuts and bolts of the program.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. And is there an amount you'd recommend for 1.11 and 1.12 for the...
Yes, there is. $750,000, so it would be $250,000 for each program, and that is split over 2 years because the program is a two-year program. So it would be $125,000 in the first year of the biennium for each pilot, and $125,000 in the second year of the biennium.
Thank you,
Ms. Forbush.
Good morning. First of all, I want to thank Senator Bonoff for her wonderful leadership around this program. And I'd also like to thank Senator Nino and Senator Torres-Ray for authoring the bill. And I'd like to thank our Chair Wiegand for hearing this bill this morning. I'm Mari Forbush. I'm the COO at Jewish Family and Children's Service. And we have over 30 programs that we run. And I want to say I think the Parent-Child Home Program is the program of which I am most proud because it engages young families and it changes their lives forever. The program is voluntary. When we began the program, we're in our seventh year now. We had a program that served children in the schools, and it was for elementary school children for at-risk families. And we realized with those families, we were getting to them too late. So the person who was directing that program started doing research, and she came upon the parent-child home program. The parent-child home program engages families who voluntarily become involved with the program. They are visited by a home visitor twice a week for 30 weeks a year for 2 years. The parent, home visitor brings an educational book or toy for the first visit each week and sort of models using that with the parents. The second visit, the home visitor then kind of watches the parent interact with the child around that toy or book. The families are given the toys and books to keep. Sometimes the first book that we bring into that home is the first book that's ever been in that home. And what the program does is it teaches parents to be their child's first and best educator. It also teaches them that their child is responding to them, and they interact with the child, and it's sort of mutually reinforcing. And this relationship grows. The parent realizes that, wow, I have a really smart kid. And they think, I must be smart, too. And a lot of times they go back to school. They get their GED. The whole family comes up. And because this program has had so much history, and it was developed by an academician who knew the importance of research and of longitudinal research. Children who have been in this program graduate from high school at the same rate as their middle-class peers, and the children are all educationally and economically disadvantaged who come into the program. When we started the program, our coordinator just went out and knocked on doors and went to food shelves and WIC offices and CUB and recruited families. And now in our seventh year, we have a waiting list every single year because word of mouth has gotten the program out. And that's pretty much the experience of most communities. The program has been shown to be effective in urban, rural, suburban settings, and with all kinds of families and all kinds of ethnicities. It also works with families who do not speak English at home. You can teach the program in the family's native language, and the children are then much better able to learn English when they go to school. The children come to school in kindergarten ready to learn. They have the basics. They're able to attend. It's just an amazing program, and we're hopeful that you will be able to support it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Just coincidentally, timing-wise, I had a voicemail, and I was checking my phone this morning, and I listened to it, and it was from Art Rolnick. And so I called him back, and he's wintering in Arizona right now, and he said that's a wonderful thing. But he said he was calling because he was worried that we weren't going to fund early childhood education. I mean, swear, this is like just out of the blue. I have this. And I said, well, yes, we're doing all we can to fund early childhood education. And then I told him that I was going to be before the committee with the parent-child home program. And he said, you tell them to fund that program. You tell them the earlier they start, the better. So it was very cute.
One thing I did mention is children start in this program at 18 months to 2 years, then go for 2 years. And then our home visitors work with the family to find them a high-quality preschool. And then they go on to kindergarten.
Very good. Questions by the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, just one
Senator
final
Bonhoff.
Thing. I have heard stories about their graduation because there is a formal graduation when this is over and that family members have come from other countries to attend the graduation. It's a very special thing.
Yes. Senator Bonhoff, do you know if participants receive a MARS number? through the education department so that we can help track the actual progress and to do a perception check on, you know, are they ready for K?
So, Mr. Chair, they don't have a MARS number, but the parent-child home program does track these kids, and they have the data for all the years. They keep track of it. And so we can follow up with you and make sure. Do you know what identifier they're using, Ms. Forbush, to track those kids? Do you?
I don't.
We can get back to you, but I am positive that they have kept the data on that, because you have, in order to be a franchisee, you have to follow the rules with fidelity or you can't do it. Yes. And one of the most important things they have is the data collection.
And we do pre-testing on all the children and post-testing on all the children, pre-testing on the parents, post-testing on the parents. So there's just lots and lots of evidence about the success of the program.
Yeah, if we could get some follow-up information, just tracking the progress and then how it relates to that benchmark of ready for K, and when they came in, involvement in the program, and the growth.
And we do have that information for our local kids as well.
So we'll get that to you, Mr. Chair. We're grappling with this in higher ed as well because of the SLEDS project, the statewide longitudinal data system that's happening, and trying to understand if we might consider moving towards Social Security numbers, because that's the identifier that's used in higher ed as well as in the workforce. And so I would welcome a conversation as we go on about that data.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I mean, anytime we can invest in early childhood, like you mentioned Art Rolnick, it's amazing, the return. And it goes all the way back to that Scopes preschool project model that North Carolina did, and Rutgers actually did the first study on that. The parent-child home program, how does it complement, or how does it replicate what the parents as teachers programs do? And then also, Minnesota is a recipient of a home visiting grant through the Department of Health and Human Services that specifically targets the same types of individuals and families. So, you know, I guess, number one, how does it complement it? Number two, are we all having the same conversation? Because, in my opinion, Minnesota still is a very fragmented look at what early childhood is, and this is just one more of those puzzle pieces that are trying to get to an intended goal. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, somebody else asked me about the parent as teacher program, and I am not familiar with it. I've heard about it, but I don't know the structure of that program and how much it costs. I do know that this program is $4,000 per family, and that it's a pretty cost-effective use of our dollars when you look at how they actually end up faring by the time they graduate from high school, that they're still at the same level as middle-class peers. And so it's very intensive in terms of duration, and yet it's very cost-effective. So if it were up to me, I would do this program statewide. With regard to the home visiting that's part of the early learning grants, I've been disappointed that those grants are all about health home visiting. And I have been working in this area since 2005, and I have tried to change that and insert literacy as well, but that's not happening.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, the department did help me find the money the last time, and I've talked to the commissioner, and she's very supportive of this program.
Thank you very much, Senator Bonoff, Ms. Forbush, and the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. And, members, that omnibus bill tentatively will be presented on April 8th. And, as you know, we're getting our targets tomorrow officially, and it will be our intent to roll that out on April 8th. So thank you, Senator Bonoff. Next, we have Senator Dietzick, Senate File 808, Collaborative Urban Education Recruitment and Training Appropriation. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dietzick.
Hi. Thank you. We do have some handouts. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I have Senate File 808, the Collaborative Urban Educator Recruitment and Training Program, before you for your consideration. Students of color account for more than 25% of the state's students enrolled in school from pre-kindergarten level through fifth grade, and this population is growing. Minnesota has an achievement gap between students of color and their white peers, and we need to close this gap. And this program helps train culturally competent, highly qualified teachers who can bridge many cultures and produce students, future employees, who are able to compete in today's global economy. St. Thomas, Hamline, and Concordia have been involved in this program, and this year we are asking to include Augsburg. With me today is Mr. Doug Hennis, yes, from St. Thomas to explain the history of the program, and Dr. Janine Gregor from Augsburg to help explain their plan and involvement in the program.
Thank you, Senator. Chairman Wieger and members of the committee. My name is Doug Hennis. I am Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. And this morning, I'm going to speak briefly about the programs at St. Thomas, Hamline, and Concordia St. Paul have had to recruit, educate, and train teachers of color and those from different racial and ethnic groups. The three have collaborated as a consortium of sorts since 2001. St. Thomas and Hamline were first funded by the legislature in 1997 and Concordia in 1998. Our programs are complementary in our view. Concordia's program is a bachelor program and a licensure program focused on the Southeast Asian community and also the East African community. It has had 125 graduates who have gone on to work in education, and it has 20 students in its program at this time. The St. Thomas program is a post-baccalaureate licensure program. It's specialized in recent years in special education. We have 366 graduates, including Bernadia Johnson, who is the superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, and we have 22 students in a special education cohort at this time. And Hamline program also educates students for baccalaureate degrees and focuses on working with teachers in school districts once they are in their jobs. How can they succeed in urban and urban-like settings? In terms of funding, the three schools have shared nearly $1.1 million each biennium since 2001. We are in the governor's budget this year, and we did meet before the holidays with the state education commissioner and received her endorsement for our programs. The bill before you today that Senator Disick is sponsoring would nearly double to $2 million the amount of funding for our programs and would add Augsburg in. So if it was split four ways, each school would get about $500,000, which would be an increase from what we are receiving at this time. We have met with the Augsburg administrators. We believe the Augsburg program would be complementary to ours in terms of what we're offering out there. And we're supportive of the Augsburg effort as long as it does not negatively affect our funding, which has been flat since 2001 because of, you know, state budget issues. We think we've grown a lot over the course of the years with our programs. A lot of that has been through the generosity of the legislature. I see Senator Stumpf down on my left here. He was very supportive of the program in its early years, and we appreciate anything that you can do in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Hess.
Well, thank you for asking me. My name is Janine Gregoire. I'm the chair of the Education Department at Augsburg. And thank you for asking me to testify today on additional funding for Augsburg College to be added to the Q legislative funding for Senate Bill 808. Augsburg College has had a strong focus on recruiting and mentoring undergraduate students of color to the college and providing K-12 educational and community outreach to our neighborhoods and also to Minneapolis. We were pleased to be asked by our local legislator and the East African community to further the advancement and preparation of East African teacher candidates at Augsburg. Such an effort extends the existing Q-funded programs in a number of ways. First, I think there's a clear focus on increasing the number of East African students in becoming elementary, secondary, special education, and ESL teachers. And I think this is really critical because I believe that we do not have enough to meet the needs of current public and private schools within the state. The second area is on focusing on recruiting and preparing and supporting first-generation East African students who are primarily at the undergraduate level with a strong content preparation, ongoing K-12 service learning within the community, and leadership development. And the third and final point that I'd like to make is that Augsburg Teacher Licensure Program is in both Minneapolis and in Rochester, would enable East African students from both the Cedar Riverside neighborhood and surrounding Minneapolis and St. Paul areas and South Central Minnesota, primarily the communities of Rochester, Owatonna, and Faribault, to complete their licensure programs and teach within their home communities. We've heard from educators and administrators within those areas. It's difficult to recruit and maintain teachers of color within those areas. There's a significant number of East African immigrants within the Rochester, Owatonna, and Faribault, Willmar area. The Augsburg East program, as we would call it, the East African student-to-teacher program, builds on existing college and community relationships and creates specific program elements that meets the unique cultural and educational needs for East African teacher leaders. The Augsburg East program has four distinct phases. You can read about those in the handout that I have provided to you. The first is the pre-college undergraduate and recruitment preparation. Really, as we think about this, attracting students of color and East African students of color really starts in middle school and high school. So having opportunities to engage our students with those communities, I think, is really important and something that we already do. Early education experiences and mentoring for freshmen and sophomores. Deeper connections to teaching and the community in the junior and senior year. And then once students have received licensure, launching their career and giving them opportunities to give back to the community. Each phase builds on and enhances an existing service at Augsburg to create clear pathways for East African students to move from high school through undergraduate preparation, through teacher licensure, and ultimately back into the service of their community. Greater details, I have said, are on the proposal that we have put forward to you. I think the scholarship funding from the Q would enable more East African teacher candidates access to high-quality teacher education within the metro and south central areas of Minnesota and maintain support for them as they progress through their undergraduate program through licensure. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee would entertain. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gregoire. Questions of the testifiers or Senator Dietzick? Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, this really isn't a question for the testifiers. Maybe it's more a question for you. But considering this is a bill for recruiting, educating, and training teachers of color, would this bill not be more correctly placed in the higher education?
Senator Dames and Senator Bonhoff just entered, actually, and we might offer a challenge on this. Senator Dames pointed out for the Urban Educator Collaborative whether that might be booked out of higher ed, as it's a grant to colleges, and, of course, we're, you know, I think the intent for it coming out of our budget is, you know, because of the teachers going into the classroom, and so it's more historical why we've done this, but the point's well taken. I believe Mr. Hennis was going to respond, then I'll ask Senator Bonhoff if she'd like to.
Yes, Chairman Wieger, members of the committee. That question has been raised a number of times in the past, and the feeling has always been, yes, the money is going to higher education institutions, but they are training and working with teachers who are in public school districts. And so the feeling always has been that it's been most appropriate to be funded out of K-12.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, I think you could create rationale for both, but let's just look at the size of the budgets. We have the K-12. Traditionally, how much do we spend in K-12?
Not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough.
$14 billion.
Exactly. $14 billion versus less than two. So I think it's really a question of resources.
Yeah.
But certainly, point is well taken. It could be in either one. And I think Senator Stumpf has said that it has been gone back and forth over the years.
Senator Stumpf, is that what you said?
Mr. Chairman, I think it has actually. I think it has started in higher ed years ago, and then somehow kind of moved over to K-12. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exact year, but so it's got its roots in both sides, I think.
Senator Dames.
Well, just to follow up, and I think that I understand the process and understand why we're doing it, but I think that does create kind of a slippery slope if we're going to, pretty soon we'll see other programs coming over here because they're educating teachers that will teach in a classroom. And I think that's a slippery slope, but I'll certainly respect your decisions, whatever they are, but I think we're on a slippery slope here.
Okay. Further comments or questions by members? I had one. I believe, Mr. Hanschu, you said there's been 125 graduates of the program, or whatever that number is.
Well, Senator Weger, actually, with the three different schools that have been involved, the Concordia program, 125 bachelor degree graduates gone on into education. The St. Thomas program has had 366 graduates, people who have received licensure. They already have their bachelor's degrees. They receive licensure. Most of those go on to get a master's degree as well. And then the Hamline program has prepared 275 students of color for teaching. In addition to that, it's worked with teachers in the school districts once they're in their position. So collectively, the programs it's been in the thousands when you add in everything that Hamline has done in the classrooms.
And Mr. Hannes, do you have information on how many are teaching right now in Minnesota? And you can supply this to us. So what percentage are still teaching in Minnesota schools?
Yes, Senator, we have a handout we can leave with you. The St. Thomas program, just to look at one of them, of our 366 graduates, 85% of whom are people of color, 75% still work in the education field, and 67% are still in Minnesota. Across 24 school districts, 14 charter schools. 67%. So two out of three since 1991, over a 20-year period, are still in education in Minnesota. So the attrition rate typically for positions like this is 50%. And in our case, it's we've been able to hold on to two out of three, and they've stayed active in education.
Okay, thank you. Senator Johnson and Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chair and members, I need to remark a bit about responsibilities being turned over to E-12, Senator Dames, as you mentioned. And this is something that we've talked about. It is not about criticizing anybody's project. It all comes from the same pool, from our state funds. But the thing that is important, and we've talked about health and human services, so many of our schools are providing really services that are not education, but they're important. They're necessary. But the thing that is, I think, something to consider is that when people talk about education funding takes 50% of our budget, and what are you doing with all of that money that comes to education? And education kind of gets a bit of a black eye or a bad reputation as taking too much money without showing academic progress instead of thinking about how much we're doing for the welfare of the children, not really academic progress that teachers and principals and superintendents are educated for. That's the reason I think it's important for us to keep thinking about that. And, Senator Dames, I appreciate you bringing it up.
Sir South.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think it's also good to point out that, and the presenters may have mentioned it already, that the money that the state puts in is not the total amount of the cost of the program. So really, in a sense, higher education is and I'm not sure if it's like one-third that would come from the state and two-thirds from the higher ed. I'm not sure what the exact split is, but this is more of a, you could kind of look at it as kind of a matching amount of money that the state puts in, kind of a seed money, so to speak.
Mr. Hennis.
Chairman, Senator Stump's point is right on target. In our the cases with our three schools, and it would be with Augsburg's as well, we've had established programs, and we've been able to expand them because of funding that we've received from the state. But we put in a lot of our own funds, and we could get you a split if you would like it. But and then the state money helps supplement that, and essentially allows us to lower what we have to charge people to go through the program.
Thank you, Mr. Hens. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I never questioned the validity of the program. I just was questioning how we were funding it, just for the record.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Senator Dietzick, concluding remarks before we lay it over.
Thank you for your time today. I think this is a good program. As I said before, we do have an achievement gap, and I think this is just one of the different tools that it gives us to help close that gap and actually to get more people of color and teachers of color in the schools. Thank you.
Senator Dietzick, testifiers, thank you very much, and Senate File 808 will be laid over. Thank you. Senator Metzen has two bills, Senate File 23 and Senate File 304 for South St. Paul Special School District 6 Alternative Facilities and
Thank
for
you.
Indoor Heights. Welcome, Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Senator and Chairman and members of the committee. Senate File 23 allows South St. Paul School District to equal access to the Alternative Facilities Program in order to meet their growing list of deferred maintenance costs. So we have roof replacement problems, HVAC upgrades, parking lot repairs, and the list goes on and on. And as you know, it's more cost-effective to keep these buildings and their infrastructure up to maintenance and up to speed than to defer this maintenance because it costs it to double or triple later on. We have the superintendent of schools with me today, Mr. Dave Webb. We do have a resolution from the school board. And I tell you what, two of these buildings are so old, two of the three that I went to. So.
Still standing.
They're still standing, but we need a little help.
I mean, until Tuesday.
I'm sure Senator Housley probably attended a couple of them, too, along the way. And we got a great education. I don't know. It wasn't so good in my case. But anyway, I had the superintendent here, and we have a business manager, and we have the building and grounds director here for further discussion if you wish, but I'll let the superintendent visit with you for a minute.
Welcome, superintendent.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We are just...
And please state your name for
the Thank you. It's Dr. Dave Webb, and superintendent of South St. Paul Schools.
Proceed.
All right. We're pleased to have the opportunity today to ask for access to the Alternative Facilities Program on behalf of our school district. I do have behind me Deb Blackburn, our business manager, and Glenn Bernstengel, who's not only our maintenance director, but also the director of maintenance for the city of South St. Paul. And I think that that position best exemplifies the amount of budget management that we're trying to do in cooperation with the city to manage our overall costs. Well, we're looking for access to the Alternative Facilities Program. And as Senator Metzen stated very well, our buildings more than qualify in age. Our average age is 44 years. Our high school is over 90 years old, and it's a beautiful centerpiece of our community. But long story short, we are not big enough with current regulations and guidelines to qualify. So we have the same deferred maintenance needs of every district in the state, and because of the age of our buildings, I would say more. And we currently receive a levy, but it's about a tenth of what Alternative Facilities Program candidates or qualifiers receive. Just open with that. We also we have a handout today, and I'm not sure if you've received this, but we've listed a five-year feel free to. We have our five-year maintenance expenditures. We always project out what's coming up, what's next year, 2 years, 3 years. Our typical annual costs are about $1 million. They're $940,000. And our allotment that we receive for our deferred maintenance levy is about $240,000. So you can see that we have to continue to make up that difference, and we're looking for your help today.
Thank you, Superintendent. I noticed you had an education facility attached right with your hockey arena, didn't you?
Yeah, we actually, another cooperative with our city, we have our CLC, our Community Learning Center. It's really an ALC that's located right in the arena itself.
And you get square footage for that?
We lease levy from the city for that space.
Thanks. Okay.
I think our city, not only our school district, but our city is and tried to collaborate in many areas. For example, we merged the Sauceto Fire Department, merged with the West St. Paul Fire Department to do as good a job or better than they did before, but we're going to save some money doing that. And I think the CAC merged with Inver Grove Heights. That's another example.
We share food service as well.
And I think these are the kinds of things that all of our communities, I think, going forward, with the budget constraints that we all have to start doing this collaboration more and more of this as we go forward. So the city and the school boards of West St. Paul, South St. Paul, and Inver Grove have been doing this, I think, long before it became very fashionable. We started this stuff 15, 20 years ago with Inver Grove. We did the fire department 5, 6 years ago, and I think this is the direction that we have to go around here to save resources and still do the job. So I give a compliment to the school district for
their innovation. Yeah, we salute those efforts, and Senator Bonhoff, especially any collaboration and working together. And as you said, it's been done for quite some time. And you mentioned the director of maintenance behind you. Now is this a joint employee of the city and the
school district? Glenn, if Glenn could make his way up.
If you'd like to join us and state your name for the record and offer a few points to share and support.
Just quickly, that the city had an opening there, and the city, along with the school district, got this fine gentleman to do the job for both the city and the school district. So,
welcome.
Say it's working.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Bernstein. I've been with the school district for about 25 years. I'm born and raised, went to school with Senator Housley. We take a lot of pride.
She looks so much younger than
me. What can I say? We take a lot of pride in our community, not only the school district, but the city. I am also currently public works director, work with the different entities at the city, and we're hoping for some nicer weather, like I'm sure everybody else is, because we're sick of the snow, just kind of a side note. But back to the matter at hand, again, we take a lot of pride in our school district. Every year we develop a plan like we present it to you, and we'd love to implement it. We go as far as we can. We end up prioritizing things as best we can. And then we've been fortunate throughout the years that the voters have supported either a bond referendum or those types of things, where we've had a component of that as deferred maintenance, and we've been able to catch up. So if we could get on level playing field with some of the other districts, it'll allow us to not play in that catch-up game about every 10 years. And so that's what we're asking for. We just would like to be able to access these funds like the larger districts do, and be more proactive with our facilities and stay more current rather than developing a long deferred list and then playing catch-up about every 10 years. So I guess that's how I'd best summarize the matter at hand.
Thank you very much. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if we could hear from the department on why there are those restrictions, like 1,850,000 square feet of space and 15 years of age in terms of the buildings, or 1,500,000 square feet of space and 35 years older in buildings.
That's the statute. But I believe, Mr. Corte, would you like to respond? And, you know, as he approaches, we definitely know there's need. And it's whether we are going to lower that, the threshold for qualification. But please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Darren Corte with the Minnesota Department of Education. Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe you're correct that those guidelines are the statutory requirements.
Sarah Stump, follow up.
Oh, sorry,
Mr. Chairman, what happens if we would cut those in half?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I can't say what the specific additional cost would be, but I think you'd obviously bring a lot more facilities and districts into the program. But as far as what the estimated cost of doing something like that would be, I'm not sure.
Well, Mr. Wilms might take an attempt at that.
Yeah, Chairman and Senators, the adjusting the requirements for who's included in the program would create a significant cost in terms of levy, because without voter approval, school districts can levy annually for a pay-as-you-go amount, and then according to the fiscal note, in this case, there would be an increase of about $350,000 one time, about $300,000, $400,000 one time, and then additional $100,000 every year pay-as-you-go. So by adjusting those requirements, it creates a significant cost for school districts that would all be included in the program that haven't been before.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that this is a levy that the school district can do, and I don't believe it's state money. So, and I would just suggest that no matter what size your buildings are, if it's $1.2 million or whatever it is, and we have problems with 600 square feet, why wouldn't it probably apply to us? So that's just makes sense that it's kind of equal footing here, I think.
Sarah Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I'm looking at the handout that you provided, South St. Paul Public Schools. And on the fourth bullet point in the front page, you state that it's more cost-effective to keep existing infrastructure in the state in a state of good repair than allowing it to deteriorate, et cetera. I think this is something that we want to think about, especially right now. Everybody is so tight. We are also tight on money and want to try to spend our money very frugally and with great care. And this might be a way to really help to alleviate future costs more than we think. So I hope as a committee we will spend some time.
Thank you.
Further questions, comments by the committee member? Senator Housley, you've been mentioned three times.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And hello, Glenn. I haven't seen you since 82, I think. No, and I'm going to be back with Forest Lake, too, so I understand what you guys are saying.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sarah Ninau and Sarah Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a question for fiscal staff. I'm just looking at 304 and 23 in the fiscal notes, and the fiscal notes give us different results, and the bills are basically identical. What are the interactions internally here that are giving us this disparate result in the two fiscal notes?
Chairman,
that's
Senator,
the beauty of K-12 funding. You do the same thing, and it does different things in different ways.
In the case of 23, we generate an appropriation savings, and that's because the South St. Paul School District receives deferred maintenance state aid. And so by going into the alternative facilities, they will forego that state aid, generate the savings, and then it creates a levy cost. So in both cases, 23 and 304, it's the same levy cost approximately in terms of what's generated, but in the case of South St. Paul, there's that aid that they're foregoing. So that's the key difference.
Sir Stump.
Mr. Chairman and members, isn't the big difference that would be that this is not a voter-approved levy? I mean, I think we do need to examine the policies, because I think a lot of our facilities are aging, and Senator Metzen certainly brings this issue to the committee. And I think the issue before was, if you look at the ration or the size of the facilities before, were primarily aimed at huge districts such as St. Paul, Minneapolis, maybe Duluth, just a handful of districts. I think there's maybe nine or so districts, I think, that have the alternative facilities authority.
I think it's 25 now.
25 now.
Well, there's always been that temptation to lower the line, and that's been done.
And so I think that the difference was that the thinking was that it was very difficult to run referendums in these large cities. So I think the question for us is, do we give the board the authority to levy to fix up the buildings without having it be a voter-approved levy? And I think that's really the issue before us.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And to that point, where Senator Stumpf is going, it's a great argument to have, because, you know, local control, school boards will tell you, give us the ability. This is why we get elected, and I'm agreeing with you in that. I'm wondering, of the 47 school districts that currently at our zero levy, the majority of those are probably out in a rule. My assumption is they would probably be ruled. Does anybody know offhand? Because this would really get to the matter, saying, were our levies, you know, passing more often than not? But I agree, let the school boards have that local decision and local control. They're the ones that are going to be accountable on that local level. So do we know offhand 47?
I don't. Just to say, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, that's what I mentioned early in my presentation, that the school board unanimously approved this at the local level. So I think that is important. They've got their election certificates, and yep. Some of us talk about local control, and they did vote in favor of this.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, I brought this forward a couple of years ago for Wayzata, it was said. But the way that we ended up doing it is that Wayzata was able to show that they weren't at their levy cap, that they didn't need all of the levy that they had authority for, so they switched their levy authority into this, so it was didn't have to carry any dollars. In fact, they were going to actually come in under, and that didn't even work in terms of triggering fiscal impact, because then there was an alternative savings that had to be carried. But the bottom line is that we had to really – it took us 2 years of trying, and the only way we did it was to be able to demonstrate that we didn't have to carry a target for property increase. So just as historical.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, one further caveat, which maybe complicates it rather than tries to simplify it, is that this committee will probably receive its targets tomorrow, and we actually received two targets. One aid target, which is kind of the general fund spending, the other target being levy target. And so whatever those targets are, and especially the levy target, that's the one that hedges us in, so to speak. And the way we dealt with it in the past has been, we can buy off that levy target. So, like, if we raise levies from zero, let's say if we raise levies $20 million somewheres for some program, some place in the state, we could take and buy that levy off with cash or with general fund spending. So that, and how they operate this year, I'm not sure, but we'll find out, I'm sure, tomorrow. The chair will know. And if we operate the same way, then if we create property tax increases and we have a zero levy target, that that creates a dilemma, especially when this, when the bill gets to the tax committee.
And Senator Squire will be presenting some a bill and some ideas to our committee on Thursday. Just a heads up on that. Okay, well, Senator Metz and testifiers, thank you very much. We'll lay that over and go next to Senate File 304, a similar proposal for Invergrove Heights.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's true. This is a similar proposal relating to the deferred maintenance alternative money for the Independent School 199, which is essentially Invergrove Heights. And with me today, I have Jason Hutzenberger, Director of the Business Services, and Paul Mandel, who is on our school board, and to testify. But essentially, I think it's pretty close to the one we just did. And I would like to go first. Mr. Paul Mandel is, besides being on the school board, he works for the state of Minnesota on the area, what do you call it, the architecture?
Capital area, architectural planning board.
Architectural board, so you probably see him around here, around here before. And he's pretty heavy on the state capitol building itself, the new stuff we're doing to the building. But Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Paul Mandel. I'm usually testifying on behalf of the capitol or memorials. I've been here 25 years as a principal planner for the capital area architectural and planning board. The chair has been on our board at times. But today I'm here as a school board member for Invergrove Heights, District 199. I came onto the board 9 years ago, just at the time we passed our last bond referendum. That was to replace our middle school, a California-designed middle school with skylights and open hallways, believe it or not, that had more water in the boiler room than it did in the pool. We had... that was a $39 million levy. Invergrove Heights right now, today, has 17% of the population with kids of school age. So it's extremely difficult to pass levies or bonds. When we passed that one, the first effort failed. We usually run twice because the first time they're not convinced of the urgency. The second time we actually did videos of people slogging through the boiler room with hip waders, and that sort of convinced people. But we did have to reduce the levy. As a result, we have a 5-year maintenance plan that we instituted when we built those new sections of the middle school, and we have yet to implement it because we don't have enough money to do so. When we do levies, the same thing happens. The last two levies we passed were without inflation, without any increase. And I know the school board, being a member of Association of Metropolitan School Districts, we've always been asking for permission to go for levies without voter approval if you don't ask for an increase, even an inflation increase. It becomes extremely difficult when you're constantly going to the voters and you're only 17% of the people feel any investment in the schools. We've done a lot in the intervening 10 years. We have student-led science technology workshop day where the students in elementary school and middle school will be the instructors for a Saturday where they are showing parents and senior citizens and community members how to work with iPads, iPods, laptops, etc. Being someone who did not grow up with computers, I have taken advantage of this and I continue to be embarrassed by how much a fifth grader knows compared to myself with regard to technology. But as you know, as all of you know who work and spend many, many hours here in the Capitol building, taking care of infrastructure is far better than letting it deteriorate. And our buildings are deteriorating. We have roof needs, we have classroom needs, we have technology needs. We have not been able to pass a technology levy. And we have many, many needs that cannot get met. The board has been supportive of the MASBO effort to try to change this whole formula because a lot of the school districts around us, Lakeville, Burnsville, South Washington County, Eagan, all have levy. We do not have levy right now, so we have no deferred maintenance money coming in. And so our need is desperate, and we are simply trying to take care of what we have. With that, I'll let Jason do some talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Mutzenberger. I'm Director of Business Services for Embry Grove Heights Community School District. Thank you for allowing us to come today and offer our proposal. Deferred maintenance is a major problem for all school districts. At Embry Grove Heights, as Mr. Mandel pointed out, we certainly have our own challenges that we face in maintaining our facilities. Of those 25 large districts that have access to the full program, they are levying, on average, $659 per pupil. In Embry Grove, that amounts to almost 10 times our deferred maintenance revenue that we receive. The quality of our educational facilities directly impacts the educational outcomes of our students. Now, we talked about some of the requirements earlier with South St. Paul. We agree that the eligibility should be based on age and condition. But the requirements also currently state that it's off the size of the buildings, the square footage. And just because some districts are large, we don't believe that means they should have access to more funding. We all have those same deferred maintenance needs. The requirements also state that we need to submit a 10-year facility improvement plan. We do have a plan in the district over a 10-year period. Currently, those deferred maintenance needs amount to $17.7 million. We try and chip away at that as much as we can each year. The $17 million amounts to about $403 per pupil over that 10-year period. That's still significantly less than what those large districts are currently receiving for additional funding. We see three reasons to grant the authority. Number one, we're facing those challenges in maintaining our facilities while providing technology resources for our students. We've had multiple technology referendums fail in the previous few years and are struggling to keep up with our surrounding districts. Access to this funding would allow us to provide proper facilities for our students. It would free up the operating capital revenue for items like technology, other equipment, and instructional materials. Number two, it would enhance local control. Mr. Mandel, I'm sure, would agree that the board would prefer to have the ability to make those decisions and to properly maintain safe school facilities. And number three, by eliminating the inequity, would allow Embry Grove Heights access to this alternative facilities program. We would be able to meet our deferred maintenance needs and provide our students the opportunity to meet their desired educational outcomes without worrying about the quality of their facilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the proposal? Not, and I know the Association of Metro School Districts was mentioned in the testimony. They're here, and they've documented the needs in many of their districts as well, and it's a challenge before us. I definitely will commit to during the interim is reevaluating all of the facility needs and expenditures that are needed. We did this 14 years ago, actually, and did make some changes in the law to have a few more districts eligible, but ultimately we're dealing with additional investment, and it's significant. It's multi-billions of dollars in terms of the ultimate outlay, but and also there's the issue of voter approval, but we need to look at it, and as to what we can do this session remains to be seen, but you've clearly have stated a need for us, and we appreciate that. So we will lay Senate file 304 over for possible inclusion, and Senator
Chairman, maybe we can look at that. The years too might be one way to do it. That 35 years instead of 50 years are named in there in the legislation now.
Yeah, there's
maybe we could maybe that would be some kind of a compromise. Just look at the age too. The years. I think 35 might do it for one of our districts, maybe two, but.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Metzen.
Thank you very much.
Each district and how we look at the square footage or in the years and et cetera, and there's different needs, but we'll be working further with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We have next on file 1309, Senator Claussen, education building lease levy max amount increase. Welcome, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
For the record, my name is Greg Claussen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to share with you Senate File 1309. A little bit of history. The Minnesota legislature created the ability for local school boards to make an additional non-voter approved property tax levy to rent or lease buildings for instructional purposes. Senate File 1309 amends Minnesota Statute 2012, Subdivision 1, Section 126C.40, by increasing the amount school districts may levy for lease arrangements from 150 to 175 times the resident pupil units. And to provide a perspective, I think you have a handout. It's a handout which identifies lease levies payable in 2013 for all Minnesota school districts. Mr. Chair, do you have that handout?
Yes.
Yeah. Appears you do. Thank you. In the past, lease levy authority has been granted to many districts to provide revenue to accommodate early childhood family education programs and community education programs. Districts must apply to the Department of Education for permission to implement a lease levy. In recent years, there has been an increased emphasis on early childhood education and all-day kindergarten. The increase in per pupil unit levy amount will provide additional facility flexibility to local school districts. And at this time, I'd like you to hear from Mr. Scott Kernquist, the Executive Director for the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Scott Kernquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1309 this morning, and we want to thank Senator Claussen for bringing this forward. As you have discussed in previous hearings, full-day K is an issue that seems to have a high priority this year, and we're very excited about that. It's an issue that we think Minnesota has waited too long to move forward on, and so we're excited at the prospect of moving that forward. One challenge, though, that does arise with moving towards full-day K is for some of our school districts, they're pretty strapped in terms of facility space. And so Senate File 1309 could help alleviate some of that problem and grant some additional flexibility and authority for school districts to make sure they will have the classroom space they need to move forward with programs like full-day kindergarten. So I'm going to leave it there, Mr. Chairman and members, and turn it over to Dee Dee Caring, who's the school business director from the Eastern Carver County Schools, and she can give you a little better idea of some of the repercussions at the school district level.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Scott mentioned, I'm Dee Dee Caring, Director of Finance and Operations for Eastern Carver County Schools, a southwestern metro school district serving the cities of Carver, Chan, Hassan, Chaska, and Victoria. And we serve approximately 9,000 students, and we're unique in the situation where we're a growing school district, and we'll continue to see growth in our area. And so many of our schools, especially on the western side of our school district, are at full capacity or an over capacity. So we currently do lease levy for some properties to house our facilities needs for our students. We see a growth in that coming forward that will be a dire need. In looking at our all-day kindergarten, currently we have 15 classrooms of all-day kindergarten, 13 of half-day kindergarten. If we were to offer all-day kindergarten in our school district, we anticipate that would be about 7 to 10 additional classrooms, which we do not have the space for at this time. And working with our architect, he indicates that we would need to lease a facility that's anywhere up to about 25,000 square feet. And in doing so, that cost, including all the amenities that are necessary for a program, would be around $165,000 a year to lease that program. While we could also use portable classrooms, there are a number of items that go along with portable classrooms that are required by cities to install that, and so the costs go up as far as those go. We are a school district that does have some capacity left in our lease levy, but we have other needs that, as a growing school district, are going to come forward in the near future, and that includes our early childhood family education, our early childhood special education, and then as well as our transitional program for students of needs over 18. Anticipating all of those needs, we would be close to just under $100,000 remaining of our $1.7 million of lease levy authority. And I do know that some of our neighboring school districts are already at capacity and have no further lease levy authority. So to implement all-day kindergarten, which is a fabulous opportunity for families, it does put a burden on school districts to find additional space for lease as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kering. I believe you have the ability to petition the commissioner now on this subject, but I'd like Mr. Arneson to address that and any other comments regarding the proposal.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. For districts at the 150 per pupil unit cap, those districts can petition the commissioner for increases to this cap. There's no statutory cap to the amount of increase. The increase is available for up to 5 years under certain conditions. And this reference here is 126C.40, paragraph G. It's also in the bill as unchanged language. So if the school district is experiencing pupil enrollment growth in the preceding 5 years, the purpose of the increased levy is in long-term public interest. The purpose of the increased levy promotes co-location of government services. And finally, the purpose of the increased levy is in the long-term interest of the district by avoiding the construction of school facilities. So it appears there's some flexibility for relatively short-term, temporary, kind of bridging-style needs, but it perhaps isn't a very robust solution in the very long term.
Thank you. Questions of the testifiers? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kuhnquist, as I look at the handout, it appears most of our districts have quite a bit of cap in their lease levy, especially in growing districts. Certainly bonding for to build additional classroom space, as we did in prior Lake Savage, is an option. Why look at the lease levy versus voter-approved bonding if the program is well-supported in the community?
Mr. Kuhnquist.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt, certainly bonding is another option. One of the challenges that arises, as you know, school districts over and over are needing to go to the voters, though, to approve operating referendum. And the voters tend to get a little weary of approving referenda. And so, and then sometimes we think it's maybe might be more cost effective to use the lease levy approach if you don't need a whole new building, but an addition might suffice to have the classroom space you need. So we think this just gives one more toolbox for school districts to use.
Further questions, comments by the Senator Stumpf?
Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure who to direct it to, but I know each individual circumstance can have its own unique issues, but generally, is it more cost effective to own the facility, a building, especially if it looks like it's going to be in use for a period of time versus leasing it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I think that varies from district to district. I think you'd have to look at your enrollment trends. Could this be a short-term solution, or is there a longer-term solution that's needed? So I think it would really vary between districts as far as their long-term plan for facilities and what may best suit their needs.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Claussen, could you define short-term, long-term, or how, from a school administrator's perspective, 10 years, would that be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, usually for budgeting purposes, we look out 3 years. That's many times difficult because you don't know what the appropriation might be from the legislature. But I think in looking at facilities generally, I know what my experience has been, we'd look out 7 to 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, maybe one intermediate solution might be to adjust the commissioner's authority to from 5 years to 10 years, or 5 years to 7 years, or something. You know, that would. If a district, if there's fluctuation in the enrollment, I can see where a district may not want to run a bond issue, but still need space for the upcoming 5 to 10 years. So it might be easier if to go the route of the commissioner. That way, I don't think we trigger levy increases either. So.
Sarah Johnson?
Yes, I, Mr. Chair, and whoever might want to wish to respond, I'm looking at the handout here and picked out Fridley Public School District. 99% of their, they are using 99% of their levy. And for instance, right now, when we're talking about all-day kindergarten, a district like Fridley and others who are close to it, 83% Columbia Heights, they're old school districts, and there is not going to be much growth in their communities because there isn't any land left. But they would definitely have a need for additional lease levy, I would think, because it would likely be temporary. Mm-hmm. Their needs would be temporary. And I think those are the things that anybody would look at. And you can go down the list and see those that are very high, like up in the 80s and so forth, probably similar. Am I on track?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, you are on track, I believe. And another thing I would point out, the two districts you mentioned are districts that offer full-day kindergarten district-wide. So I think that does give you an idea that once the district makes that commitment to full-day K, they tend to push right up against that lease levy cap, the existing cap.
So, Mr.
Johnson.
Chair, and then Mr. Kronquist, maybe you could indicate, are the other districts that are very high on this handout, would they likely have all-day kindergarten already in place? Brooklyn Center, Wayzata, Minnetonka?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, not all of them are, but Minnetonka does not have district-wide full-day K, but there's other reasons that a district may be bumping up against that.
And cap. Mr. Chair, again, just to say again that those schools are looking definitely, our districts are looking definitely at a greater number of students coming into their schools than they didn't anticipate before we passed the bill this year, if we pass it through to law.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Stumpf made an excellent suggestion that the department might look at increasing that petition process for maybe up to 10 years or some other option. And so we would ask the department if they could develop a recommendation on that. And Mr. Corte, you don't have to have a full response, but acknowledge it. And
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, yes, I was actually just in the process of sending an email to Dr. Melcher to see how many times we've used this, we've granted authority to districts under that paragraph, so I'll be sure to get that information to the committee as soon as I receive it.
Thank you. Further questions by the committee? And Senator Clausen, closing remarks?
Just one more comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one other consideration to think about is that within the lease levy authority, if a school district needs to add capacity at their school, they have the authority up to a 20% of the square footage to add that capacity. I believe they might be doing that at Prior Lake School District. And that is another opportunity for schools to continue to add a little bit of space where it's needed to the schools and make some modification and use the lease levy authority to do that. So if the schools were to have a little bit higher cap on that, they could do that within that capability and provide the school within the school that's already there, thus utilizing the administration and an overhead that you would already have in place instead of having it a separate location.
And Senator Claussen, would like to wrap up?
Just one last comment. Local units of government, school boards are the only local unit of government that is restricted on lease levies. Counties have leases that do not go to the public. Cities have leases that do not go to the public, or levies, rather. And I think granting this option to school districts provides flexibility to meet the needs of those individual districts, especially when you look at some of the increased demands about special education, early childhood education, community education programs, and all day kindergarten.
Thank you very much, Senator Claussen. And you know, clearly, as we look at the potential of all day K and other needs, growing needs, we need to provide flexibility. So this will be given close review and put for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and it will be laid over.
Thank you.
Next, our final two bills are from Senator Kent, Senate File 1042, SciMath, Minnesota, and Senate File 1267, Minnesota Reading Corps. These would be appropriate for each program. Have before us Senate File 1042, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Very excited to be here before you with a couple of, I think, very interesting bills that accomplish a lot of things that we've been talking a lot about over the past couple of months. First of all, to start this morning, I am pleased to present Senate File 1042, which requests an appropriation to SciMath Minnesota to advance science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, initiatives that will add an effective tool in educating our students, preparing our workforce, and maintaining Minnesota's national and global competitiveness. SciMath Minnesota is a nonprofit organization which brings together a powerful coalition of business and education partners to advocate for high-quality K-12 STEM education. SciMath Minnesota has been a vital partner with the state since its inception 20 years ago. As a recent example, committee members may recall that Minnesota has participated as a mini-nation in the TIMSS, or Trends in International Math and Science Studies test, which enables us to compare our students with those from around the globe. SciMath Minnesota conducted the analysis and disseminates the results across the state. Two other key initiatives of SciMath Minnesota include the Minnesota STEM Network and the award-winning STEM Teacher Center website that houses the Minnesota Mathematics and Science Frameworks, both of which provide excellent tools and resources to enhance STEM education, teaching, and learning. This bill would appropriate funds to expand the Minnesota STEM Network and enhances the Minnesota STEM Teacher Center website and its comprehensive collection of science and mathematics frameworks to make the site more interactive for the user. It's important to note that there are over 30 state networks across the nation, with many states providing substantial financial support. This organization has relied and will continue to rely on the support of volunteers and corporate contributions. However, accomplishing these two important tasks will require an investment beyond their current capabilities. Minnesota businesses, like 3M in my own district, are highly interested, and rightly so, in ensuring that they have a well-educated workforce. In fact, I've been speaking over the past few weeks quite a bit about the fact that 3M, for example, has been very open about the fact that they're going to have a big retirement of their of a cohort of their baby boomers soon, and they're going to have a hard time replacing them, and that they're not necessarily even going to be able to home grow as many workers as they're going to need, that they're going to need to attract from outside. Well, I always say to that, we need to home grow as many as we possibly can, and it's initiatives like this that are going to help us do that. Today, there are over 120,000 high-tech workers in Minnesota. These jobs are well compensated at an average wage of $79,200, quite a bit higher than the state's average private sector wage. There are 7,900 high-tech businesses in the state that have a payroll totaling nearly $10 billion in 2010. And many of the fastest-growing jobs are STEM-related. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, by 2018, we're going to need 37% more biochemists, 40% more medical scientists, 41% more financial examiners, 53% more network systems analysts, and 72% more biomedical engineers. I hope we can all agree that the key to meeting our grand challenges, to improving our health, to harnessing clean energy, to protecting our security, and succeeding in the global economy, will be reaffirming and strengthening Minnesota's role as the engine of scientific discovery and technological innovation. Success tomorrow depends on how we educate our students today, especially in those fields that hold the promise of producing future innovations and innovators. That's why STEM education is so important. Thank you so much for your attention and support. And now I'd like to turn it over to SciMath Minnesotans Board Chair Richard Hudson.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Welcome. Please state your name for the tape.
Richard Hudson, the chair of SciMath Min. I'm also the director of science production at TPT. Thank you, everyone on the committee, for the chance to discuss the proposed legislation with you this morning. Meeting these grand challenges is really why SciMath exists, why it was formed in the first place. As Senator Kent said, we are a small 501c3 organization. We started in 1993 with support from the legislature. That support ended in 2002, but we've continued our work since that time, and we're very proud of all we've accomplished in this, our 20th anniversary year. SciMath Min makes the connections between the many diverse stakeholders, and I'm sure in these hearings you hear from all of them. Our purpose is to connect them together, to give them opportunities to communicate. And the stakeholders we include is a big list. Legislators, leaders in business, industry, healthcare, workforce development, educators and administrators of pre-K-12 schools and higher education, after-school educators, informal science educators in museums and TV shows, STEM professionals, scientists and engineers, they collaborate with us, leaders of nonprofit STEM organizations, community organizations, corporate and private foundations. They're all in the SciMath Min Circle. And our goal by bringing them together is to become an unbiased, nonpartisan resource to help Minnesota achieve the highest standards in STEM education and build the world-class STEM workforce we all want. So over the last 20 years, we've brought these stakeholders together in many different forums. We've brought in speakers to inform the state. We've supported statewide professional development. We've done this important research with the TIM study and provided analysis that have really helped us do better in STEM. You might be surprised to learn that the annual operating budget of SciMath Min is less than $40,000. We rely on volunteers. We do get separate grants for restricted purposes, and we've managed grants up to $750,000 successfully. Our budget has remained stable over the last decade through contributions primarily from the corporate community, but it's not grown appreciably, and yet we are taking up some important new challenges, and that's what's in the bill you have before you today. There are two items, the Minnesota STEM Network and the Science and Mathematics Frameworks Collection, housed in the online Minnesota STEM Teacher Center. And you have some samples of these in the papers we put out for you this morning. The projects are related. That may not be evident from when you look at the detail. The STEM Network builds a communication web of stakeholders, and the STEM Teacher Center provides that critical technical infrastructure to serve the audience of teachers across the state. We're requesting $200,000 per year for the next 2 years, and we will leverage this funding, as Senator Kent mentioned, to raise additional funds from corporate and foundation sources. So let me say a couple words about each of these initiatives, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues to give you a little more detail. The first initiative, the Minnesota STEM Network, is designed to extend the work we do as SciMath Min statewide, to connect the stakeholders all over the state, enabling them to share their best practices, their most successful strategies, and lift all boats in STEM education everywhere. We've been developing this network over the past 3 years, bringing stakeholders together each spring to collaborate on a vision. We now have some 400 people across the state involved in planning this idea. We hope that some of you may join us on May 15th at St. Catherine University for the next event. I have to insert here that I am a rural Minnesota boy from Senator Dame's district, and I have some personal perspective about the need to connect STEM educators across the state. And I still can remember the March blizzard that kept me from getting my science fair project from Redwood Falls down to Minnesota. It was a very disappointing day. I put so much work into that thing. But there's a lot of interesting activity going on all over the state, and we really don't communicate with each other enough about those successes and about the needs for improvement. Last year, with Clifton Larson Allen and Boston Scientific, we did an in-depth analysis of the needs across the state and created a strategic plan for this network. And as my colleague Ann will tell you, we're developing a plan for 6 hubs, and these are already in development. But we can't move forward without basic support for staff and expenses. So part of our request will go to developing this network, getting the staff to organize at these regional levels and bring them all together. The second related initiative is the Minnesota STEM Teacher Center and the frameworks for math and science standards. SciMath Min has contributed to frameworks in the past. In 1998, we created 2 volumes of mathematics and science frameworks, which really became the Bibles for how to implement standards in the classroom for a generation of teachers. Those were paper. What we're doing now is online. We engaged dozens of educators across the state with a grant from the Minnesota Department of Education and created a set of frameworks which now exist online. Just to frame this, the standards, as you know, are the goals. The frameworks give the teachers the real toolbox that they can use in the classroom. Now, I am somewhat biased here, but I think if you look online at this collection, and Marty Davis will lead you through it in a moment, it's the most comprehensive and easy-to-use collection of frameworks anywhere in the nation. But it's only the beginning. It only provides the basic skeleton of what can really serve teachers and allow them to collaborate and learn from each other. In a sense, it's a searchable encyclopedia right now. Our goal with this bill is to add new functions to the site where teachers can comment on the frameworks, add new content, communicate with each other, share and discuss their activities and their assessments. We also want to add technology and engineering standards and techniques for teaching STEM to special education students and English language learners. So again, we're at a point where a dedicated committee of volunteers has put together a great plan, but we need the support this bill will provide to move it forward. So with that overview of these 2 initiatives, I'd like to introduce 2 SciMath Min board members, my colleague Ann Hornickel, who has led the development of the STEM network, and then Marty Davis from St. Paul Schools, who will tell you some great stories about how teachers are using the frameworks. And then we'll have a little time for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson.
Welcome, Ms. Hornickel.
Mr. Chair and the committee. I am Ann Hornickel, a board member of SciMath Min since 2008 and a member of its executive committee since 2010. I also work for the University of Minnesota as program director of the North Star STEM Alliance, which is a partnership of 17 Minnesota colleges, universities, and community organizations, which all work together to increase the number of minority students receiving bachelor's degrees in science, technology, engineering, and math. As Richard said, I have led the development of the Minnesota STEM Network with the support of the SciMathMin board and a volunteer leadership team since the grassroots effort began to take shape in fall 2009. The Minnesota STEM Network is a community of practice engaging all vested interests in the effectiveness of STEM education and workforce development, essentially providers, funders, and advocates of STEM. Richard has listed these sectors in detail. Again, they essentially come from business, education, and community, youth development, and professional organizations. Goals of the Minnesota STEM Network include increasing awareness and excitement for STEM, about promoting effective STEM teaching and learning, closing the STEM achievement gap, and increasing the number of students selecting STEM as a career opportunity, particularly minority and students and females. These STEM stakeholders all play a part in engaging youth and adults interested in STEM by building passion, increasing knowledge, and revealing pathways to STEM careers for our youth. But we don't just do this one time for them. We must sustain this effort over a 15-year period from about middle elementary school all the way into the middle of post-secondary education. One aspect of the proposed bill is a public portal which provides an easily accessible inventory of existing programs to guide parents, students, and teachers towards STEM programs. And like Amazon recommending another book to buy, we would be able to highlight programs that will keep youth engaged in STEM for years to come. Richard has mentioned how our statewide network has grown sevenfold in 4 years. Through networking and events, we get to know one another and share research, data, and best practices. But more significantly, local and regional networks can address local challenges by assessing needs and identifying strategies that increase engagement in STEM. And there's two really great examples already in Minnesota. The Rochester Area Math and Science Partnership has been in existence for 20 years, bringing together the Mayo Clinic, IBM, 13 superintendents in area districts, and the representatives of higher education in the area for dialogue on continuous improvement in K-12 math and science. The Hibbing Engineering Advisory Committee, formed in 2006, brings together professional engineers, high school teachers, community college faculty, the Hibbing Chamber of Commerce, the Iron Mining Association, and the Iron Range Resources Group. To assess what would increase student engagement in engineering and the range, they want to retain their youth in the STEM fields in their community. They have 9 significant deliverables with positive outcomes in only a few years. We do not have to look very far for great examples of how to do this work together. A key strategy of the Minnesota STEM Network is to facilitate the development of similar regional organizations and link them together as a statewide network. I proposed and was awarded a Bush Fellowship in 2011 intended to develop regional STEM networks. So far, I have brought the vision to over 300 STEM stakeholders across the state. And here is a sampling of our progress. In Northeast Minnesota, we've held a regional meeting of STEM stakeholders last November, attracting an overflow attendance of over 100 stakeholders, and then formed a leadership team of 28 leaders who have met 3 times since November to articulate their goals and strategies for their region. In Southwest Minnesota, leaders will meet on April 15th to discuss their next step in regional network formation. Leaders in the Fargo-Moorhead region will meet on April 2nd to discuss the same. Other areas in development include Central Minnesota and Northwest Minnesota. In Southeast Minnesota, the Rochester Area Math and Science Partnership Board may consider its relationship to a regional STEM network at its retreat this summer. And you can see on the map provided the general outline of where these networks are. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, STEM stakeholders participate in local events, STEM Day at the State Fair on opening day, and the annual conference, which has grown 266% in 4 years. As Richard mentioned, this year's annual conference is May 15th, which will feature best practices in STEM education across the state. Even far greater growth is anticipated based on this past year of regional network development and making the conference available through distance learning technology.
STEM networks are not unique to Minnesota. Since the first networks formed in approximately 2006, now there are over 30 state STEM networks with broad community engagement, as we've been discussing, and an additional 12 that are just very well developed in the education sector. Iowa, for example, has a governor's advisory committee led by the lieutenant governor and state support of $4.5 million, plus an additional $2 million from corporate support. This type of work is an application of the social innovation strategy called collective impact to address complex social problems. In this case, it's engaging students in STEM from a variety of backgrounds over a 15-year period and overcoming a severe achievement gap. Wherever I have taken this vision, it has been well received. Mo Benda, a member of the Hibbing Engineering Advisory Committee and a leader in the Northeast leadership team, described this. A need has been identified in Northeast Minnesota to capture these STEM efforts, share best practices, and harness collaborative effort for a more far-reaching impact. The Northeast Minnesota STEM Network has surfaced at an extraordinary time where the need has been identified and STEM passionate leaders who share common goals are literally sitting at the table. The regional network development effort is well associated with the STEM Teacher Center, which Marty Davis will describe shortly. The STEM Teacher Center will evolve from a rich resource to an online community of teachers and STEM education faculty. These educators are also engaged in the STEM network and thus connecting to the community expertise and resources to enhance their teaching. Now multiple regions are ready to move forward, especially Northeast Minnesota, which is ready for needs assessment and baseline data. But SciMath Min will need support from state, major funders, and business and industry to sustain multiple growing regional networks. The Minnesota STEM Network, in conjunction with the STEM Teacher Center, can have significant impact on student knowledge and interest in STEM in the coming years through a broader base of support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Davis, please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Marty Davis. I'm also a board member of SciMath Min and science program manager for St. Paul Public Schools. I just want to share real quickly some real concrete ways that the work of SciMath Min is affecting education in Minnesota through the teachers and the teaching they're able to provide by the resources SciMath Min provides, specifically the frameworks. In St. Paul right now, we're really working on our immersion language programs. We have a French, Spanish, a Mandarin, and a Hmong immersion program. And as you can imagine, you really can't walk to your local teacher supply store and pick up a Mandarin science book that's going to meet the science standards for Minnesota. I mean, these things have to be created from scratch. So we have a team of very, very competent, qualified teachers coming together to look at how to integrate math, science, technology together in a way that's going to help their students. I'm working with these teachers as a resource through my district, and one of the standards they were looking at were life cycles, something we all know about, you know, typical elementary type science understanding. Well, these teachers kind of came together, and one of them was saying, well, we should just do butterflies, monarchs. You know, that'll get us the life cycles. And the other one, no, we should raise chicks. You know, second grade, that's what kids love the little cute chickies and everything. They can see the eggs, and we can do all this. And they were talking back and forth, and they were having a professional debate on what they should do. Well, I kind of stepped in and said, you know what? Why don't you guys open up your computers, go to the SciMath Min website, go to the frameworks, just take a look at it. Maybe that'll give you some ideas on which way would be better to go. And I stepped back. I came back about 5-10 minutes later. All looked at me and go, we were really off, weren't we? And I kind of said, well, what do you think? The end result was they realized that neither one of their approaches was going to be deep enough to meet the standard as it was written. These are competent teachers who have been teaching for a number of years, that needed that extra resource that the frameworks provided for them to understand what the standard was asking them to do. It isn't understanding just about butterflies or chicks. It's understanding all life has a cycle. All life needs to go through it. And focusing on only one animal or one organism wasn't going to get it. In fact, they even had to, they realized they had to start bringing in plants. Well, the end result was this unit that they created was much deeper, much richer, much longer than what they had ever thought about, brought in much more math, more technology, and is something that's really going to be wonderful for their students. Their students are really going to have a strong understanding of what life cycles are. The next thing they asked me was, so how can we share this with other people? And I didn't have an answer. That's this next step. That's what this bill is asking you to help us do. We don't need to be out there recreating the wheel. What we need to be able to do is share these best ideas, work with them, tweak them for the people that are around us in our particular settings, and use that. I have other examples that I can talk about. Habitats, a teacher that recreated her whole room into this wonderful, beautiful desert. I mean, everything was there, swirl cactus, everything. And she thought, oh, well, that's teaching habitats. She got into the framework. She saw the misconceptions students come with. She saw some of the resources. Within a year, she changed her whole entire unit that she'd been doing for 5 years and worked on diligently. And her students' scores started to rise dramatically on that part of the test that she gives on habitats. So the work that we're doing here is critical. And the resource we have is fantastic. It works. But to ask teachers, as busy as they are, to continually have to recreate something that somebody down the road may have already given some time and thought into, we just don't have time for it in the schools. There's just too much to do. And what we're asking for you is some help and support so teachers have a forum to share this with each other. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Questions from the committee? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think on the bill, lines 1.19 and 1.20 are actually not needed.
Okay.
So I would just move to delete that. We can't commit a future legislature to something. So normally we would not put that in there. It doesn't really affect the bill itself.
Okay, we're about to remove that provision, Senator Kent.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Yes, thank you, Senator Stump.
The Senator Stump's motion to delete lines 19 and 20. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you. Further comments, questions about all the great activities that are happening? And I had one that I'd like to ask. How does the program relate to the Department of Education and their best practices and, you know, the centers where they're going out and talking to people, and you have a group of people on your board, but I'm not sure who's there from the Department of Education, and you're working on the standards. So if you could show me how this all comes together.
We have three board members in regular attendance: Doug Paulson, who is here today, Sue Wagon, and John Olson. And it might be appropriate, actually, for Doug to say a word about that. I would say hand in glove, actually, in the way we work together and have for these 20 years. Doug?
Welcome. Thank you. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, my name is Doug Paulson. I'm a STEM specialist for the State of Minnesota Department of Education. And the partnership has been really close. The development of the framework was funding that was legislatively approved, not passed biennium, but the previous biennium, in Statute 122A.72, which is funding toward our Minnesota Mathematics and Science Teacher Centers. And so it was meant to be a virtual house to help support the professional development that is currently being funded through federal legislation, Title IIB funds, mathematics and science partnership funds, and so really leveraging some of the work that we have in best practices with some of the professional development that is provided through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And so the work that has been done with the frameworks and with SciMathMin has been vital to our support for mathematics and science education and STEM education in Minnesota, and the partnership has been very close and will continue to be very closely aligned and developed. And so we have appreciated SciMathMin's work with that, and Richard had mentioned, myself, John Olson, who's our science specialist, and Sue Weigand, who's our mathematics specialist, are ex officio on the SciMathMin board, and those positions have been with the SciMathMin board since SciMathMin was housed at the department back in the early 2000s.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? Well, very well done, and clearly you stated the need, and we will lay this over for possible inclusion in our bill. Thank you. Senator Kent, we have Senate File 1267, the Minnesota Reading Corps Program Appropriation.
Shifting gears. Different yet similar. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. At this point, I would like to introduce Senate File 1267, which requests the appropriation for the Minnesota Reading Corps for the next biennium. Again, as with the previous bill, we're looking at an impressive nonprofit organization that makes a real difference in bringing together a number of goals. The Reading Corps is one of the best bang for the buck initiatives we have, focused on one of the primary issues we've identified in this committee, working on literacy from age 3 to grade 3. It's a powerful private-public partnership that leverages dollars, federal, state, and private, into results that speak for themselves. First of all, this isn't just feel-good programming. By statute, Serve Minnesota programs are required to show a return on investment and thus have implemented strong outcomes-based initiatives with results to prove it. Working with students who are initially targeted as being below proficiency in reading, the Reading Corps gets amazing results with a very modest state investment. Nearly 28,000 struggling readers will receive support from the Reading Corps this year, and over 80% will move from below proficiency to above proficiency. Outside evaluators have shown that Reading Corps students have a statistically significant lower referral rate into special education services, thereby saving the state and local districts more than $9 million annually. And it's a win-win. For the 28,000 students who receive support, it works out to less than $800 per student, while at the same time, we're providing valuable experience and training for the Reading Corps volunteers, helping them prepare for success in their futures and in our communities. As far as the partnership is concerned, currently the Reading Corps receives nearly $12 million in federal funding, $1.7 million in private support, and $4.1 million from the state. Unfortunately, we can no longer rely on this federal portion due to the sequester and other cost cutting. And practically speaking, we are essentially maxed out on private support, although Serve Minnesota is still working hard to find new sources. So if the state merely maintains spending at the level of the last biennium, Reading Corps would have to cut the number of students who receive services. At the same time, the recognition of all the success means the demand continues to grow. This school year, 2012-13, Reading Corps supports 1,000 volunteers serving 28,000 students. But the need and current school district requests are for 1,400 volunteers, 40% above what they're doing now. Reading Corps, showing care about potential expansion, hopes to grow at a more conservative and manageable rate to 1,200 volunteers next year in 2013-14 and 1,300 volunteers in 2014-15, which would mean serving an additional 12,500 students over the biennium. And those are the numbers that are reflected in the appropriation request in the bill. So in order to deliver these results, Senate File 1267 would increase the state appropriation for the Minnesota Reading Corps, allowing the Reading Corps to scale up to begin meeting this increased demand from Minnesota schools, providing reading support for an additional 12,500 over the biennium. Thank you for your attention and your support. And now I'd like to introduce Dr. David Heistad, Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment with Bloomington Public Schools.
Welcome, Dr. Heistad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, my name is Dave Heisted. I'm the Executive Director of Research, Evaluation, Assessment in Bloomington Public Schools. Before that, I spent 15 years as the Research Director in Minneapolis Public Schools. And I've had the opportunity to do several scientific studies of the impact of the Reading Corps. And I'll refer to the handouts that you just received with the color graphs and just briefly go through some of the data that have been collected by myself and other researchers. First of all, I'd like to reinforce what Senator Kent said about this being a research-based intervention that has a lot of substantial literature showing the effectiveness of these types of interventions with young children. And also, I'd like to reinforce the fact that the studies that have been conducted are rigorous studies that have included comparison groups of identical type students so that the results that we're showing are models of a causal relationship, that the program has actually caused this improvement in reading. I'll take you further through the first slide. At the top of the first page, you'll see that we've established benchmarks for preschool literacy and link them up with the state tests so that what you see on this graph are areas of pre-reading, rhyming, picture naming, alliteration, which is the beginning sounds in words, and then looking at letters and creating the sounds associated with those letters and then naming those letters. And you can see that each one of these areas, we've seen an increase in the percentage of students who have met the state target, indicating that they're on track for proficiency in grade 3 reading. At the bottom of the page, you'll see the results of a study I conducted with Head Start program in Minneapolis Public Schools. We identified a number of Head Start classrooms where there was an AmeriCorps volunteer working in that classroom. We found the characteristics of the students in those classrooms and matched them to other students in the Head Start program that were not receiving a reading course support. And then we compared them to other programs of students coming into Minneapolis Public Schools that had identical backgrounds. So we matched on English language learner status, free and reduced price lunch, on whether the students were homeless or highly mobile, and other important factors that predict reading. And what we found was that the reading course students produced significantly higher achievement when the students were entered into kindergarten. And it turned out that Head Start students in general did a little bit better than non-Head Start students. But the big difference was that the Head Start students having reading core support did significantly better than the non-reading core students in both Head Start and non-Head Start preschool programs. On the second page, or on the back of that page, at the top, you'll see that the reading core actually does diagnostic assessment throughout the program. And this is an example of three different classrooms. You can see that the blue classroom had 0% of the students were proficient in the fall of the year, and then 40% in the winter, and then finished up with 85%. So the teachers find out the areas that are strengths for each of the students and then weaknesses. In this particular area, hearing the sounds of the letters was a problem for students in Classroom A, and you can see with intensive support those students improved. So there's good diagnostic information for the teachers and also for program evaluation. The most recent study that I did looked at the question about special education referral and placement. The question was asked, do students that participate in Reading Corps have a lower frequency of special ed placement the next year? And to do this study, we again controlled for all of the demographic characteristics of students and also the prior test scores. So we would get the fall test score in grade one, and we would match the students in Reading Corps with students with identical pretest scores, identical demographics, and then look to see what was the special ed placement the next year. And it turned out that the special ed placement for Reading Corps students was 2.5 times less than for the non-Reading Corps. And I did this analysis with a colleague whom you probably know, Bob Wadle, the former commissioner of education. He did the cost analysis and came up with an estimated savings of $9 million across the state if this result was extrapolated to the whole state. This was a very not only statistically significant finding, but practically important finding. And as mentioned by Senator Kent, the percentage of students who are proficient by grade 3 is about 80% this last year in 2012. And all of the students, it's a criterion for entering to the program that they have to be not on track for proficiency. So students, actually, when they're assessed at third grade, tend to be proficient. But there's still a gap. There's 20% of the students that aren't proficient yet. And one of the exciting things about working with the Reading Corps is that they're always trying to improve what they're doing to make it more effective. The effectiveness has been greatest at the early preschool, kindergarten, first grade. It's a little less effective at second and third grade. So what is it about pre-reading and reading skills in second and third grade? Well, a lot of us have heard about this kind of you read to learn, and then at first you learn to read, you learn the basic concepts, and then you read to learn. And a big component of that is comprehension and vocabulary. And so Reading Corps has been working with the University of Minnesota to test out interventions for vocabulary. And the preliminary results look very encouraging, that adding a vocabulary component to Reading Corps could enhance the outcomes for these students as they head towards third grade. So that, if it's brought to scale, I think it will have an interesting study to report back to you. So those are basically the findings that I thought I would highlight. And at the end, I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Heiston. Ms. DeWitt.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle DeWitt, and I'm the principal at Highland Elementary School in Columbia Heights Public Schools. So I can attest, however, to the fact that Columbia Heights Public Schools is growing, because as our homes are selling in Columbia Heights, new families move in with 3 and 4 and more students per home to a home that was an empty nest. So we are growing. We just put an addition on my school that opened up mid-year for a kindergarten center. Highland is a full-day, everyday kindergarten elementary school. Minnesota Reading Corps has been a tremendous benefit to my school, as this year we have 2 Minnesota Reading Corps tutors working with us full-time. They serve approximately 15 students each, depending on their schedule. These Minnesota Reading Corps members work one-on-one with our students. They are highly trained to identify the needs of students. They do frequent assessment to ensure that the methods that they are using are finding excellent results. They communicate their results with their internal coach as well as with building administration, so they keep us informed. They also keep families informed and engaged. I can also speak about the progress that we have seen through our involvement with Minnesota Reading Corps. Last year, our overall percentage of proficiency on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment for third graders was 89%. However, the students receiving Minnesota Reading Corps support were 95% proficient on the third grade assessment. So we also keep very careful data, as we were a school that was basically through AYP, we were consolidation or restructuring. However, last year, based on our significant improvement, we were able to apply to Celebrate and then were considered a Celebration school. And in part because of our high third grade proficiency as well as our ability to close the achievement gap. Holland was 97th percentile compared to other Title I schools in Minnesota for closing the achievement gap. We really connect, again, our Minnesota Reading Corps tutors with our teachers to ensure that the results that we're getting are benefiting students. And this program has really helped us overcome high obstacles with high free and reduced lunch percentage of 80% and high EL population varying between 40 and 45% each year. But we have been able to overcome high obstacles with their support.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to hear such great news when you've been able to turn things around. And I know that it's got to be tough for the staff, the parents, and but you put together a plan and you come up with these types of results. It's so wonderful to hear that. So we appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from the committee? I had a question on the early learning pre-K. Is there a MARS number assigned, Dr. Heistad, to those participants?
Yes, there is a MARS number, and we match then students from the Head Start program to the Minneapolis beginning of kindergarten assessment using that MARS number. It enables us to do very well-controlled studies.
Thank you. And one further question. I know we're here for Reading Corps now, but Math Corps, can any comments from the testifiers regarding how you blend these programs together?
I just would mention, Chair Weaker, that Bloomington Public Schools is pleased that we'll be having three schools involved in the Math Corps, and I've volunteered to do another match sample analysis to see the impacts of that Math Corps. The three school principals are very encouraged. It's the area that, even though we're having high proficiency in math, we feel that we could really improve with the Math Corps.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. DeWitt?
Mr. Chair, we do not currently have any Math Corps members. We applied last year and were not able to be placed with any.
Okay. It seemed to me that closing the achievement gap is based in large part on how we can get everyone at proficiency in reading and math. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just editorializing, you have numbers. And I know, Dr. Heistad, you do this for a living, and you can show growth. So that has a great deal of impact when we can translate the big proposal to specifics in the classroom, and this is what it's doing. It's getting us to 95 or 98%. That is closing the achievement gap, and I appreciate that on behalf of the committee that you have been able to document that so effectively and state those outcomes.
And Mr. Chair, I would thank you for making those linkages, and that's one of the things that I think has been, you know, I've heard wonderful things about both of these initiatives for a long time, and to really sort of dive in and see some of the details. When it comes to reading, they do age 3 to grade 3. So part of it is that linkage between pre-K and making sure that all of that is sustained into K so that you reach that third grade proficiency level. And so there's the wisdom in that, and that's such a tool and such an example that can be learned from across the board.
then you move into math, and that begins at fourth grade, I believe, right? And so you're right, proficiency there too, but it's all happening at these different developmental stages for the students and then within the curriculum as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. And again, this will be laid over for possible inclusion, Senate File 1267.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, on the agenda for Wednesday, you'll see that we have four bills at this point before us. On Thursday, we'll be meeting again. And I know Senator Scoy will be addressing us on at least one of his proposals. And I'm waiting to get a couple of other bills referred to us. I believe we're going to hear Senator Housley's bill.
Not before break.
But right after break. And but if anyone else has a request, please let me know, because it's going to be very difficult to accommodate those once we roll out our bill, which will be April 8th or so, but right a week after break. And so we'll have the policy bill before us soon, but it's not technically referred to us, but then Senator Torres Rayo will present that. And I would imagine that would be the first week after break, possibly Thursday, though, if it's referred to us. Since at least half of you have heard and participated in that bill, we may focus on some of the areas, where other members may have some questions, but we'll take the time that you need, but want to be respectful that we've spent a great deal of time, many of us, on this. So we're going to bring that up once it's before us with Senator Torres Rae. Any questions on where we're at this point? Very good. At this point, we will adjourn, and if there's any particular items that you want to talk about individually, I've talked to a few of you, please let me know. We're adjourned.